The court's ready to hear argument in Webb v. State. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Rumina.
Good morning, Your Honors.
You know when the yellow light comes on, you'll be using your rebuttal time.
Yes, I think I've already reserved 5 minutes of that, and I've told the court clerk.
Well, when the yellow light comes on, if you continue to speak, that's fine. You'll just be using that 5 minutes.
I understand, Your Honor.
Very well.
Your Honor, we're here today on the appeal of Roy L. Webb. He was charged and convicted of rape in the first degree. Basically, the facts of this case is that he was living with his girlfriend and the alleged victim, who was 13 at the time. And basically, the victim became pregnant and gave birth to a child. At that point in time, I guess Division of Social Services came involved. The child initially claimed that somebody else was the father, was interviewed by the police, ultimately claimed that Mr. Webb was the father. Paternity tests were done as well as family court actions. And basically, it was admitted and stipulated at trial that the paternity test came in showing that he was 99.99% the father, listed on the birth certificate, and that was done without objection. The only real issue at trial, which I think the state agrees, is basically whether this happened intentionally or some mistake. Mr. Webb testified that basically he came home, he was drunk, somebody came into her room, he thought it was his wife. Ultimately, it was the victim.
Let me stop you right there because I found this point confusing. Explain to me how mistake of identity is a defense to this crime.
Well, mistake of identity, basically, I guess, as far as the intentional part of it, if he believed that he was having sex with his wife and not the alleged victim, then that would be, in our position, a defense, which basically was presented to the jury, and that was the issue that was presented. I didn't try the case, so that was what was presented to the jury at the time.
Well, if a defendant claimed that I was mistaken as to the age of the person I was having sex with, would that be a viable defense?
No, that would not be a viable defense. But if I'm believing I'm having sex with one person, which is my wife or my girlfriend or somebody else, and in reality I'm not, then I believe that would be a defense that the jury can view and say that, no, it wasn't like I'm having a person with sex with this person, I know this person, and I don't know whether she's 13 or whether she's 15 or whether she's 20. That's a different issue. Well, this, what we're arguing is that he's believing he's having sex with his girlfriend, which obviously is over 18 and has done a number of times. If, in fact, he wasn't and he believed it was his girlfriend, it was dark, he didn't know, then I would believe that would be a valid defense that the jury could consider and determine that he would be not guilty because he didn't have the mental state for the crime.
Isn't that a backdoor defense of mistake of age?
I don't believe so, because the mistake of age defense, as I understand it, is that you meet somebody, you either ask her how old you are or whatever, and she's 18 or she's under 18, and you say, well, forget it, I'm going to have sex with her anyway. In this case, that's not the case. You're having what you believe you're having sex with somebody that you know is 18, over 18. And you don't, because it's dark, you don't realize that it's somebody else. I mean, there's a distinction between the two, I believe.
Did the trial judge, give a jury instruction on mistake?
I believe so.
And do you recall, in essence, what that was?
No, because it wasn't. That really wasn't part of our appeal, so no, I don't recall. But I believe, in looking at the transcript, I believe there was, but I could be wrong. I mean, our issue on the appeal is basically what happened thereafter. And what happened thereafter is that the alleged victim had always claimed that basically she only had sex with the defendant or the appellant once. And that changed only the Friday before trial, on November the 18th of 2005. When she met with the prosecutor. And at that time, she claimed for the first time that basically it happened more than once. We then get to an issue that basically what happens is that the prosecutor at that point in time prepares notes. And in these notes, he prepares his questions that he's going to ask her. and he prepares the answers that are given. That is reviewed with the victim, the alleged victim, the child, prior to her testifying. And he tells to the judge, because there's an issue, becomes of what she testified in the, and there's a sidebar. And at that time, it's stated that, no, I have notes, I prepared my questions, I prepared the answers, I reviewed this with the victim prior to her testifying, and she said this. And the state argues that that's trial preparation, and that the notes were for the benefit of the prosecutor. But if the notes are for the benefit of the prosecutor, why then do you review those answers and those questions with the victim? And are the answers, which we don't know, through a tape statement, or is it the prosecutor's interpretation of what this victim says? And once you go through a child and say, I'm going to ask you how many times you have sex, you told me before it was three, and so forth, then, I mean, who's really testifying? And I think...
Well, isn't that all fair game for cross-examination to the alleged victim? You rehearsed your testimony with the Deputy Attorney General, didn't you? And working your way through the scenario to show that it is not to be believed?
Well, sure, it does, but I think it goes further than that, and I think basically this court has determined for a number of years that basically prosecutors have a special duty. And in fact, this court recently, within the last month, in Baker versus State of Delaware, again talked about that in answers. And if you're viewing the fact that a prosecutor is allowed to question a victim before trial, prepare a script, basically, have answers, have questions, and review that answers and questions with the victim before trial, and of course you're dealing with a victim that's underage at this point in time, and you have to determine who's really testifying. And I think if you look at, there's two little excerpts which I want to talk to the court about, and that the victim testified before. The first time she testified about this would have been with the judge in the jury. And in that, and that's basically at page 43 of the transcript of the Tuesday, November 22nd of 2005. The question was asked, could you please explain what room this occurred in? Answer, mine. In your room, yes. Other rooms, the victim said no. Did it ever occur in his room? Yes. And basically, that's the only extent as far as the question is concerned. She then testifies less than 24 hours the next day before the jury. And again, the question is asked, and this is on page 52 of the trial transcripts of November 23rd of 2005. Could you tell the jury the different places in the house that it occurred? Answer, in my room, his room, in the living room. Prior to that, as I recall the testimony, she never talked about the living room. And what happened between less than 24 hours to change her testimony from what she told the judge without the jury and what she told the jury? The jury never saw her that. That was outside the jury's present. And I think it goes into play as far as whether this is trial preparation or whether this is coaching. And if it's coaching, yes, it is fair game for the jury. But I think it goes further than that, and I think it goes further than the fact that the prosecutor has a special obligation, and I don't think this court should allow coaching to occur if, in fact, it has occurred. And I think if you looked at what was told to the victim, what was told to the judge, as far as the statements, and the fact that this alleged the victim never said it happened more than once until he met with a prosecutor the Friday before trial. He tells the judge one thing, and basically her statements to the judge was that it didn't happen anywhere else, but it was allowed to continue, and we have two rooms. Within 24 hours, she then says it happens in the living room, her room, his room, my room, and the living room.
Could I interrupt you, because
sure.
I want to make sure I understand your argument here. Is it your complaint, basically, that because there were these various trial preparation experiences between the victim and the prosecutor where she apparently gave two, maybe even three different versions as compared to what she testified to, that you were somehow prejudiced because you weren't able to cross-examine her about the fact that, now, isn't it true that when you spoke to the prosecutor, you said this, and when you spoke to the judge, you said this, and now you're telling the jury a third thing? Is that what your complaint is?
Well, I mean, it goes to that part, and also the fact that basically the prosecutor, in a sense, has put himself almost as a witness to this, and he can't be called. And you got the fact
have... But in this case, you already knew that she had given two different answers, I guess altogether three different answers. First, that it happened only once. Second, that it happened in two locations, therefore it happened at least twice. And then third, her testimony at trial. So you were in a position to impeach her completely, weren't you?
Not necessarily.
Why not?
And when I say not necessarily is because prior to the trial, this revelation as far as happened more than once, it happened on Friday. At that point in time, they find out that it happens. She testifies. They don't talk about the other offenses. He testifies and rebuttal comes out. The first time it comes out that it happened. I'm not even sure if they knew exactly how many times, because in the question to the judge, there wasn't any times. We just had two rooms, his room and my room, so presumably we have twice. The living room comes out the next time. At that point in time, we're towards the end of the trial because we're on a rebuttal. She's already testified. So they're limited to what happens, and when they find out about it, from Friday to, I think, Wednesday is when the trial then, you know, we're talking less than a week.
Well,
so
let me see. Are you saying that she talked about this happening on multiple occasions during the state's case in chief? I thought the multiple occasions only came in after he denied having sex other than on one occasion.
That's correct. In the rebuttal, except for the fact that there was a voir dire with the judge, and that's when he was making the Getz determination, and that was outside the presence of a jury, and that was, I guess, the second day of trial, and she testified on the third day.
But we agree the record reflects she testified about the one incident that led to the birth of her child only during the case in chief.
That's correct.
Okay.
And when we talk about the Getz decision, what the issue was is that whether it was plain, clear, and conclusive. And based on the record that was presented to the trial judge, our position is that it was not plain, clear, and conclusive. And if you look at the two hand-in-hand as far as the prosecution misconduct and the statements that were made throughout the trial, one issue talking about abortion coming in, which was clearly improper, and there's a curative instruction given, but who knows what the jury took from that or didn't take from that. The only issue in this case, as we both agree, was whether it was mistaken identity, whether that's a legal or not a legal issue. That was presented. That's what the jury had to determine. And basically to alleviate that, the issue of multiple times came into play. And if you look at the questions that were answered, that were objected to for the most part, and I think the state counted there was 10, a lot of them basically the state withdrew the question before the answer was given. But this court has already determined, I guess, and stated, I guess, in Baker that questions in and of itself is prejudice. You don't really have to have an answer. And I think the state, in order to ask a question, has to have a good faith belief that the answer is going to be legitimate or is going to be proper, and the question is proper in a sense.
All right. Well, trying to state your position as clearly as you can, the defendant testifies this only happened once and it happened by mistake.
That's correct.
In response to that, the state said, well, we want to show it wasn't a mistake because it happened on several occasions, so there was no mistake in identity. And they call the victim back, and she says, multiple times, multiple places. You're arguing it wasn't clear and convincing because her testimony was inconsistent?
No, I'm saying that if you look at what she testified in front of the judge, as far as the rooms, she really, I mean, it was unclear. She couldn't say the time. She couldn't say when. For the most part, it was the prosecutor testifying, not her. Her answers were yes, no, and so forth. She's already given several statements to the police, never mentioning any other times. We have the judge and the court already knew it before this happened that there were notes that were taken. She reviewed those notes as far as the testimony. Are these her words or are these the prosecutor words? And I think you look at the whole total package. I think with the whole total package, it's not plain, clear, and conclusive. And I think that the court at that point in time should not allow these other instances of misconduct to come into play, which after the appeal was filed, the defendant was arrested again for those charges, and that's pending the Superior Court. So, and we have an individual that basically, because of the charge of rape, is basically sentenced to a 15-year minimum mandatory. So obviously the consequences are serious. And he's facing two other charges based on those offenses. The trial in and of itself didn't take very long. Most of the issues were conceded. The only issue that was not was the issue we talked about. And I believe if you look at the whole transcript of the whole record of the questions and what was done, I think that the determination is that this alleged victim was more than prepared, was coached. And I don't think that a conviction should be based on testimony from a coached victim.
Well, and were these other charges, do they specify the date and place that the crimes occurred, the alleged crimes?
I think it's the same as these things, a range of dates, and basically it was based on the alleged sex that it would have occurred in her room and would have occurred in the living room.
Do you want to save the rest of the time?
Yeah, sure.
Good morning, Mr. Williams.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. May it please the court. I'll respond to the first argument, which I guess has been primarily the focus of the oral argument this morning. But if there's any questions about the second argument deals with the admission, of other uncharged crimes evidence and rebuttal. And I guess the two do overlap to some extent. As I understand the argument this morning, the focus is on alleged coaching of the complaining witness.
Before you get into that,
yes.
Clear up my problem,
okay.
If you would. Is it a defense that you were mistaken as to the identity of a victim when they're charged with this crime?
I think it is in the sense that you're mistaken as to the identity of the victim. It's not a defense for mistake as to age. And the jury was charged on mistake as to age is not a defense. They were given a specific instruction. His argument, Mr. Webb's argument, is a little bit different. It's not denying that he had sexual relations with the complaining witness. His focus is, I didn't think that it was Key. I thought it was her mother, Cassandra.
I understand exactly what his claim is, and I'm just wondering, is there any case law on this? Is there any basis for for the state conceding that that's a valid defense?
Well, I don't know that there's any Delaware case law. It's sort of an unusual defense, and obviously the jury didn't buy it. They were out less than an hour in this case. But I think the general law is that you have to have the specific intent to commit a crime.
I thought in the case of something like a sexual crime, all you have to do is have the intent to have sex. And as to who the victim is, you don't have to have any intent as to that.
Well, I don't know. If that's the law, then this would have been a much simpler case. It would have been virtually a strict liability case once we introduced the paternity evidence. And I think the defendant conceded that he was the father, and his name, I believe, is on the child's birth certificate as well. But I think the state had to go further and actually rebut this assertion that he was making. And I don't have any specific law to cite to the court, but I think that's part of the state's burden, that we still have to show his assertion that he was mistaken as to the identity, that there isn't any rational basis for that, and that was a question of credibility that the jury, as a trier of fact, had to resolve here. The focus of the argument, as I understand, has been on two general areas, primarily on whether or not the prosecutor impermissibly coached the complaining witness. She was 13 at the time of the alleged offense and 15 at the time of trial. What occurred here was that the prosecutor had typed up some questions. He didn't type up the answers. It's only the questions that are typed up. And he was going over the questions with the complaining witness the week before the trial. I believe it may have actually been on a Friday, and the trial started the following week. During this interview with the complaining witness, the complaining witness was asked if she had told the state and the other individuals. I think she gave two prior statements, one to the CAC Center and another to the police, if she had told everybody exactly what had occurred, and she had not left anything out. And the concern, I think, was that initially the complaining witness had said that the father was some unidentified male living in the state of Maryland and not Mr. Webb, and it was only later on after the child was actually born and the paternity testing was done that she revealed that Mr. Webb was the father of the child, and that's what the paternity test scientific testing indicated as well. So there was some concern, I think, legitimately on the state's part, because she had said one thing initially, said something different later on, incriminating Mr. Webb specifically.
Why was that still a concern by the time you get the trial when you have a live birth with DNA test? You know, she could have said anybody was the father, but that was no longer an issue.
Well, I think it's a concern as to whether or not it's consensual or not. Now, I guess, you know, getting back to Justice Berger's question, given the age, that may not have been an issue either. But that was the assumption of the state, was that he was going to argue mistaken identity here. So the prosecutor, I guess, prudently wanted to know if there was anything else that was being left out that she had omitted or had not fully disclosed, so that there weren't going to be any surprises at trial. One of the problems we have at trial sometimes is it seems, regardless of how many times potential witnesses are interviewed, they get on the witness stand and they say something that they've never told anyone else before, and sometimes it's objectionable evidence, and everybody has to deal with it, the court and the state as well. So I think it was prudent preparation here. There's certainly no indication that the witness was unduly coached. If she had been unduly coached, her answers on voir dire before she testified on rebuttal and rebuttal presumably would have been much more consistent than they were. So I don't think there's any evidence on the basis of this record that the complaining witness was coached. The other.
Let me interrupt you here.
Sure.
When this additional evidence came in on rebuttal, was there cross-examination along the lines of, oh, wait a second, this is a new story you're telling us? You know, the first time you testified, it was just that there was one incident, and now you're saying that there are several incidents, and when you spoke to the judge a few minutes, you only said there were two. So why should we believe anything you're saying? Was there examination along those lines or not?
I don't specifically recall. I assume there would be from defense counsel.
Okay, well,
that would seem to be a reasonable cross-examination.
Right, and what I'm concerned about, concern is probably not the right word, but what I'm interested in at this point is if the state undertakes several interviews with the victim in a case like this where it's all credibility, and I mean it's not all credibility because there's a baby and all, but in terms of this purported defense and all that kind of stuff, credibility is a big deal. Okay. So if the state is engaging in multiple interrogations, interviews, whatever you want to call them, with a victim, and let's say two or three times the victim is giving different stories to the prosecutor or whoever is doing the interview on behalf of the state, how does the defendant ever know about that to be able to cross-examine effectively with respect to the fact that this person has told so many different versions of this story that we don't know which one is true?
Well, I think in this case, at least on this record, it was all laid out for the defense. It may be more problematic in situations where prior inconsistent statements aren't disclosed, but I think the state would still have an affirmative obligation under Brady to disclose inconsistent prior statements. You know, if the state knew that she had said a fourth version, which was different than any of the other three versions that we know about, then that would certainly have to be disclosed. I think the difference here was initial version was it was someone in Maryland who was the perpetrator. The second version was that it was Mr. Webb, but only one time. And the third version was kind of a variation on the second, that there was more than one occasion. The concern for the prosecutor when that information came to light was that he had to make sure that the complaining witness did not reveal any of that information on her initial direct examination until the trial judge had an opportunity to make a ruling and do a Getz analysis to, as to whether or not any of these other incidents could be admitted or not. So some preparation beyond what's normally required for a 15-year-old witness in a case like this was required just to ensure that other evidence that would not be admissible in a case in chief, perhaps, was not inadvertently revealed. So I think that's all the prosecutor was doing. It was a prudent action to do it that way, and I think it was handled appropriately given
what the prosecutor was. Okay, but in terms of my concern, what you're saying is that in a different circumstance where it didn't come out because of the voir dire with the judge and all that, that if in the normal course of the state interviewing a witness or a victim in a criminal case, getting different stories out of that person would be something that would be revealed to the defendant?
Well, I think we would have to if it, under Brady, I think we would have to, because I think that that goes to potential for guilt or not. I mean, it's a kind of confusing case in the sense that the focus was really very narrow for the jury. I mean, all they had to decide was whether or not Mr. Webb's defense was valid or not. Everything else was virtually established or conceded or stipulated to that all the other elements of this particular offense were in any case. Other cases it may be more problematic where it's not so limited in focus as to what the trier of fact had to resolve here. But I think, you know, if the state knew that there were other inconsistent stories that hadn't been revealed, then we would have an affirmative obligation, I believe, under Brady to reveal that information. So, and it has to be revealed so that the other side can make effective use of it for cross-examination purposes in this instance. The other argument that was focused on, very briefly mentioned, was the reference to abortion. And there was a mistrial motion for that. And the background and the explanation that the trial prosecutor gave was that the reason that was asked, it was actually a comment made by Mr. Webb to the mother, not the complaining witness, when the child was, I believe, at the A.I. DuPont Hospital. And it was determined that she was pregnant, and then the Mr. Webb allegedly told the mother that, well, you know what you have to do. She has to have an abortion. And the reason for interjecting this issue of abortion was not to raise a red flag or anything concerning abortion itself, but to show that there was a consciousness of guilt on the part of Mr. Webb, that at that time paternity testing hadn't been done. Obviously, the child hadn't been born yet. But if Mr. Webb knew that there was a possibility that if the child was born, that their paternity testing could be done and he could be determined to be the father, that would certainly be highly incriminatory for him. So to suggest an abortion by him was a way of disposing of potentially incriminatory evidence, and that was the reason that that issue was brought in. There was a defense objection, I believe, to the evidence. The trial judge ultimately ended up excluding it, so there really wasn't an answer on the record. And a curative or limiting instruction was given to the jury, which I think was certainly appropriate here. There were a total of 10 different complaints that were raised under the broad rubric of prosecutorial misconduct. None of them have to do with statements in an opening statement or closing argument or rebuttal closing argument. They concern either questions that were asked of witnesses at trial, which are really evidentiary rulings. Some of them were not even objected to, so there's a plain error analysis. Other statements were statements that the prosecutor made frequently at sidebar that were not heard by the jury. Some of the questions that were objected to were never answered, or the prosecutor voluntarily moved on to another line of questioning. And I think either individually or collectively that none of these 10 challenge comments by the prosecutor were improper, and there was certainly not a repetitive pattern of improper conduct by the prosecutor in this case, such that a Hunter analysis would also be applicable here. If there's any specific questions that the court has, I'll certainly try to answer those. Great. Thank you very much.
The only issue that really I want to rebut or at least bring some issue on it is the last conversation with Justice Berger involving these statements and the duty of the state to disclose inconsistent statements. And in this case, on the record that we have an individual that's made certain statements. She's made a statement to the prosecutor the Friday before trial. We don't necessarily know what the extent of that statement is other than that there's other times. She then testifies in front of a judge in voir dire, and she claims that there's two instances that it happened, one in her room and one in his room. Doesn't talk anything about the living room. Now, is that statement consistent with what was told to the prosecutor at the time of the interview on Friday? If it isn't, then the state has a duty to disclose that, and there's nothing on the record that says that it disclosed that it's not. We then have a statement, and the next day, less than 24 hours, she then makes another statement. And that statement is that it happened in his room, my room, and the living room. Now, again, there's nothing that's presented to the court that her statement is inconsistent. The jury doesn't hear what was told to the judge. So we have at least three different versions of what happened. We don't know what was ultimately told to the state in Friday. We know what she told to the court on the next day, the 22nd, and that was in two rooms. And the state didn't say, no, that's not what she told us. She told us it happened in three rooms. And if they had an affirmative duty, then that duty would have been presented to the judge, and they had a duty to tell the judge, she testified this, but that's not what she told us. On Friday, she told us it happened in three rooms. That wasn't done. We then have this next day when she says it happened in three different rooms. The judge, the prosecutor, everybody knows that's not consistent with what you said on the 22nd. The jury doesn't know that, but everybody else does.
Well, can't you cross-examine and get the jury to find out that way?
Well, I think there was some cross-examination done, but it wasn't done to the extent that it probably should have been. But on the same token, we have basically the court making a determination that the evidence is plain, clear, and conclusive. And when you have these inconsistencies, I don't think it's plain, clear, and conclusive.
Well, to what extent does the trial judge's evaluation of the witness's credibility come into play?
Well, I think when he has to make a determination that the evidence is plain, clear, and conclusive, I think that comes into play in that regard, whether it is plain, clear, and conclusive, because that's one of the standards of Getz. And I think that I don't think you can view that as a vacuum and say, all we need to say is the victim has said that and leave everything else beyond that. I think you have to look at the circumstances
around
that.
Your argument that there is no basis in the record to find the alleged victim credible on that point?
Well, certainly that's a determination for the trial judge to make, but I think the determination has to be that I have to look at what was said before, what was said today, what was said the next day, how it was said, and whether it is or is not credible. I don't think you can make the determination and say, well, she said it, so it has to be credible. Which is, I think, what occurred. It basically says, well, she said it happened before, so it's credible. I think you have to look at the circumstances surrounding that, and that's our position.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we also take a brief recess.